100 years ago, young Laura and Earl Smith left their teaching positions in Moravia, Iowa, to stake a claim and become homesteaders in Wyoming. Today, their story. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. The Smiths spent 3 years homesteading in Wyoming before returning to Iowa, and sometime later, Laura sat down to write about their adventures. That manuscript wound up in the Iowa Women's Archives at the University of Iowa Libraries. This hour, I'll talk with John Fry, who edited and published the manuscript into the new book, Almost Pioneers, One Couple's Homesteading Adventure in the West, and Karen Mason, curator of the Iowa Women's Archives. Join our conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. By 1913, Iowa was well settled. There were towns, roads, railroads, schools, drugstores, and libraries. But out west, in Wyoming, the frontier was alive and well. In 1913, a young couple from Iowa, Earl and Laura Smith, moved to Wyoming to homestead. Later, in the 1930s, Laura wrote about their experiences in a memoir she called Almost Pioneers. Now, 100 years after Laura and Earl moved to Wyoming, the memoir has been published. And with me today is John Fry, chair of the History Department at Trinity Christian College in Palos Heights, Illinois. He edited, researched, and published this manuscript. Hello, John.
Good morning.
Thank you so much for being here today. And also with us is Karen Mason. She is curator of the Iowa Women's Archives at the University of Iowa Libraries. And that's where John Fry found this manuscript. Hello, Karen.
Hi, Charity.
Thank you so much for being here today. And John, let's go back to the beginning. When you found this manuscript, what were you looking for?
Well, I was a graduate student in history at the University of Iowa in the late 90s. I got my PhD in 2002, and I was doing research for my dissertation, which is on farmers in the Midwest and what they were reading at the turn of the 20th century. So I was in the Iowa Women's Archives looking at whatever records I could find from farmers, farm women, and reading through the things and looking for mentions of reading, books, periodicals, newspapers, whatever I could find. But when I came across the Laura Gibson Smith papers and I read Almost Pioneers, it made me slow down and read carefully and laugh out loud in the archives. It's such a wonderful manuscript.
Well, she does have a wonderful voice and a gift for writing. When you read it and you thought, wow, this is remarkable, what did it make you want to do?
I remember talking to Karen at the time about whether anybody had spoken to her about getting it published so more people could read it. And Karen said no. And so I sort of made a mental note. I was still doing research for the dissertation, but I thought, you know, if I get this finished and get this published, then that could be the next thing that I do.
Well, and Karen, when John came to you to talk about this memoir, had you read it?
Yes, I had. And I was thrilled because I thought it was great, too. It was one of those, it was actually one of the very first collections we received in the archives. I think it arrived in November. And we had opened in October. And so we, of course, were intrigued by it and charmed by it. But like so many things, it sits in a box in the archives and only that diligent researcher like John finds it. So I was really excited when John said he wanted to publish it.
And John, when you read it, I mean, it seems to me, and of course, I haven't looked at the unedited version, but it seems to me that she wrote it to be published.
Yeah, that's a good point. I think that at least it was edited probably several times after she wrote it. I think at least she wanted to share it with family members. I don't know if she had an idea of broader distribution than just that. But it is not, I mean, it's not a diary. It's not a journal. It's clearly, there's a story arc to it. And it is a narrative of her time in Wyoming.
and even has a foreword written by her husband. How did that come about?
Well, actually, so Laura and Earl homestead in Wyoming in the 19-teens. They got their land, and then they moved back to Iowa, and they lived in Iowa for most of the rest of their lives. And hence, when she wrote this memoir, she called it Almost Pioneers. Laura died in 1973, and in fact, in 1983, her son, Bert Smith, got a small publishing company in Ankeny, Iowa, that what they did was they would type up people's life stories. It was called Life Story Enterprises. Typeset them, get them bound by a bindery, make 10 or 12 copies of these things for family members. And so Bert had this done with Almost Pioneers. And when that was done, her husband, Earl, wrote the foreword to the book, which describes their marriage and their where they met in Ames and other things before Laura's manuscript begins.
Well, and it's a wonderful story in the foreword, and it certainly gives us an idea of a very impulsive, adventurous couple. She was in Chicago. He went to see her from Ames, Iowa, and they maybe were bored at the Art Institute and decided to get married that day.
Yeah, I teach in the south suburbs of Chicago, and I tell people this story, and they think that is such a Chicago thing to do.
Well, so they did get married and went back to Iowa together. They tried to continue their education, but realized that they really couldn't continue their education at that point, and then decided that they would move to Wyoming. And Karin, could you read just a couple of paragraphs for us to give us an idea?
Sure. These are the opening paragraphs of Chapter 1, Wyoming. There is a fascination about the vastness of the western plains, the rugged mountains, the uncertainty of the horizon, the crispness and clarity of the air, and the brilliance of the sunshine that captures the imagination of anyone who comes to Wyoming and draws them back if they leave. In Wyoming's great spaces, winds blow over prairies and mountains, sending Russian thistles and tumbleweeds bounding for miles, piling winter snows in deep drifts or melting it like magic. Barbed wire and buck fences stretch for miles. The atmosphere is so clear that mountains seem near and stars shine so brilliantly they look to be within reach.
And that gives us an idea of the world they were moving to. John, why did they decide they wanted to go to Wyoming?
Well, there's a couple ways of thinking about that. One is ultimately they saw Wyoming as a way to get land and get land as an investment. As you read the book, you realize that, or as I read the manuscript, I realized they never really meant to stay in Wyoming. It was a way of getting land as an investment, which they would then lease out and use to finance other pursuits. But another way of answering that is they were, when they decided to move there, they were living in Moravia, Iowa, down in Appanoose County. And a number of other people from the community there had decided to move to Wyoming and stay, or some others had decided to do the same thing and get land. And so it was something that a number of people in the community are doing. And Laura and Earl said, why don't we try this?
Well, and tell me about Earl's first trip out to Wyoming.
Yeah, so Earl went to Wyoming, and of course, all of the travel here is by the early 20th century is on trains. So he could get a train to Cheyenne and then a smaller line to Chugwater, Wyoming, which was the nearest town to where their homestead eventually was. And he got off the train, and there was a blizzard blowing. So he wasn't dressed for the blizzard. He got it undercover for stayed with a local family for several days. Chinook wind came over, melted all the snow, and he went out to look for a homestead with another local homesteader who was living in a dugout, which was dug out of a hill, and he had to deal with dirt and rocks showering down on him at night and other things that you wouldn't run into in Ames or Moravia or anywhere in Iowa.
Well, so he did. He did get a feel for how desolate the country could be. He got a taste of how brutal the weather could be. She describes how he chose the land possibly just because there was a fence that he could see. And he felt like that was something to cling to, something to look at out there. I get the impression that maybe there wasn't a lot of research to be done, or maybe they just didn't do a lot of research about what their lives would actually be like out there. They seem really unprepared.
Yeah, this is a theme that goes throughout the first half of the book, which covers their first year there, is that there's a lot of things they just weren't prepared for. They weren't prepared for not having as much water as they had in Iowa. They weren't prepared for dealing with rattlesnakes completely. They weren't ready for the boredom involved in living in the middle of nowhere by themselves. It seems that they were ahead of the group. One group from Moravia had ended up east of Chugwater. They were southwest of Chugwater. They were really the first people in the neighborhood. Their nearest neighbors were 10 miles away. And so, yeah, they didn't have a good idea of what they were getting themselves into, and they made it up as they went along.
Well, and there are a few things that she quotes herself as saying and quotes Earl as saying. One of them was that she has no intention of learning to milk a cow. And you think she's becoming a pioneer and she has no intention of ever even learning to milk a cow?
Yeah, that's it's a fascinating sort of engagement that they have with homesteading. For the most part, they didn't do most of the work required to get a homestead. They did build a house. They did fence the land. They did plow it and break it, but then they rented out the land that they plowed on shares so that somebody else was doing the work on the crops and getting the harvest. Very much they were visitors in Wyoming instead of in it for the long haul.
Definitely. Well, and it's, as I mentioned, it felt like in some ways they were unprepared. There were times when she described situations that seem very dire. One of those is that they really didn't have a way to get water when they first arrived in the shack that they'd be staying in while they built their house. And she writes about that with some humor, but that seems like a very frightening prospect.
Yeah, she never really, you know, delves into that. There's not much danger in the book. There's one point at which Earl gets himself into trouble trying to walk through the snow to the railroad station. But there was a spring somewhat nearby. They didn't know where it was, so they had to go out looking for it. But I also think this shows that this was written much later. It might have been the 1940s or 50s when she could look back and chuckle about a lot of these things. If she had written it closer to the when it happened, it might have had a different cast.
A little more immediacy, a little more fear.
Absolutely.
We're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. I'm talking with John Fry, who's the editor of the new book, Almost Pioneers, One Couple's Homesteading Adventure in the West, written by Laura Gibson Smith. And this manuscript was kept at the Iowa Women's Archives at the University of Iowa. Karen Mason is also here today. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe, and this hour we're talking about the adventures of Laura and Earl Smith. They were homesteaders who moved out to Wyoming in 1913. Laura Gibson Smith wrote about their adventures in a manuscript called Almost Pioneers, and now 100 years after this young couple from Iowa moved out to Wyoming to homestead, the manuscript has been published. It's called Almost Pioneers, One Couple's Homesteading Adventure in the West, by Laura Gibson Smith, edited by John Fry, who is here with me today. He is also the chair of the history department at Trinity Christian College in Palos Heights, Illinois. As I mentioned earlier, this manuscript was at the Iowa Women's Archives at the University of Iowa, and Karen Mason is curator of the archive. She is here with us as well today. And before the break, we were talking about how there seemed to be some very dangerous things that this couple encountered, including thirst and hunger and blizzards and rattlesnakes and all kinds of things. But the manuscript was written in the future after this happened, so it has sort of a more relaxed and almost funny feel to recount all of these adventures. But one of the things that struck me is this couple moved out to Wyoming. They didn't take very much stuff with them in order to live, but they were both quite educated. They didn't take any books at all, John.
Yeah, this is a perpetual mystery to me. She mentions at one point that they had always relied on things to read, and now they didn't have anything to read. They made sure they rode to the post office every week so they could get their Saturday evening post, and then they would read it cover to cover, and then they wouldn't have anything more to read for another week. During their first year on the homestead, it just seems incredible that they had both been school teachers in several different rural towns in Iowa. Why didn't they take anything? I can't account for it other than that possibly they didn't have the space, but you'd think that they'd be able to take several of their favorite books, or that they were once again just completely and totally unprepared when they went out there and didn't take any reading material.
Right. Well, there was a wonderful passage that they had. They finally got some neighbors, the Castors, and that was a couple with, I think, 6 children when they moved in, and they had a couple more as time went on. And she writes, "We had complained to the Castors about having nothing to read. 'I've got some books,' Luther said. 'Just wait till our goods get here and you can borrow them.' At last, the books were unpacked, and Luther handed them over proudly. He had 2 books by Mrs. Eden Southworth titled In the Depths and Out of the Depths. That was all. 'I have read better books.'" I loved that line, but again, how they made it out there with nothing at all to read.
Well, you know, they also were, she wore her best clothes, her silk stockings, or is that what
right,
they were?
Silk
when
stockings,
she was
right.
Riding on the horse, she expected Earl to meet her, but didn't realize that the mail would only come once a week and he might not have gotten the letter.
Right, so she arrived at the train station and he didn't even know she was coming and there was no way out.
No, in fact, there was no mail delivery at all. You had to ride to the station to get your mail and he just hadn't been there yet. So, you know, the person in charge of the mail handed her own letter to Earl.
Maybe you can give this to him when you see him. Yeah. The relationships are very interesting out there as well. As you mentioned, there were a number of people from Moravia, Iowa that they knew who were moving out there together, which is kind of an echo of what we saw happening with people coming from Europe and settling towns in Iowa, where there would be many people from the same place in Europe, in, you know, Scandinavia, settling in a town in Iowa. Here is an Iowa town sending a bunch of people out to Wyoming. So they knew some of the people who were coming, but they were sort of the forefront of that movement.
Yeah, they were the advance guard. It was the Smiths and then the Castors, and then nobody came until after winter, 1913, 1914. A lot of people came out in the spring, so they were ahead of the curve and all by themselves.
It was interesting to read what Laura wrote about the social hierarchy out there. I mean, there weren't that many people out there, but there was a real divide between the ranchers and the homesteaders.
Yeah, it's and interestingly, Laura and Earl bridged that to some extent. But the ranchers were very suspicious of homesteaders. They're suspicious of people who are able to claim land and put up barbed wire fences and restrict the areas that the ranchers could use for running running cattle on the public domain on government land. And homesteaders often did endear themselves to ranchers by riding across their land without, you know, talking to them beforehand and other things. But interestingly, like I said, Laura and Earl seemed to sort of cut across some of those things. They got along with the main rancher in the area very well, and also with all of their neighbors.
It's interesting that they were able to bridge that gap because they didn't actually stay year-round on their claim, as many of the families did. Earl would leave and teach school in the winter months, and Laura would go to California and stay with her family.
Yeah, the homestead law by this point had been amended so you could still prove up on your homestead if you were 7 months out of the year on the land. In fact, actually, the original Homestead Act was you had to be 9 months out of the year on the land for 5 years. Actually, by this point, it had been amended, so you had to be on the 7 months out of the year for 3 years, which made it much, you know, more possible for someone like, you know, a couple like Laura and Earl to think about doing this. It wasn't giving up 5 years of your life. It was giving up three, and you could still go, you know, back home or do other things during the winter.
Well, and you mentioned, we've talked in a number of ways about their lack of preparation. Another way that Laura doesn't seem to be very prepared for this life is she doesn't seem to know very much about cooking, at least not about baking.
Yeah, she has this great self-deprecating humor, but constantly, you know, picking on herself for not being able to manage the stove. Now, part of that may be that they had gas stoves in, you know, most of the towns in Iowa that they had lived in. So those are much easier to deal with than wood stoves.
And she does show, as she takes a young woman under her wing for a little while, in a kind of a funny episode where a new neighbor, kind of a neighbor, gets a lot of free labor out of both Earl and Laura. But she also mentors his teenage daughter and does demonstrate some competency in the kitchen there.
Yeah, she can make butter. She learned how to make butter, and she can do it better than this teenage girl who's trying to take care of her father. They've lost their mother and her older teenage brother, and she can mend and she can make a good dried peach pie. But bread was not her forte.
We talked a little bit about the danger. Let's talk about when Earl decided that he would head back to teach, and they decided to stay through December, apparently not thinking it was going to get too snowy. But, of course, there was a huge snowstorm that came up, and he set out on his snowshoes to get to Diamond so that he could get on the train to head back. And tell me a little bit about that episode.
Yeah, they were planning for him to come back to Iowa to teach. They had actually been borrowing a horse, and it turned out that the horse was repossessed. the horse was had belonged to another guy who had left homesteading and had not paid for it, and so the owners had showed up and taken the horse, and they said, "What are we going to do? You can't be out here on the prairies without the high plains without a horse." So Earl was going to go back on the railroad to Iowa. Laura was actually going to stay with her mother in California for a while, and they had planned to leave, but then this snowstorm came up and apparently snowed for 5 days in a row, at least 2 feet of snow, and Earl really wanted to get back to Iowa. He was delayed, so he made snowshoes out of boards from their house and tied them on with binder's twine, which was fine. He got on the road. Diamond Station was the nearest railway station. Chugwater was 20 miles, but Diamond was only 5 miles. And it was fine until one of the pieces of twine broke, and he had brought extra twine in order to in case this had happened, but wasn't able to get the snow out of the holes that he was feeding the twine through, and had no way. He had thought he had brought a nail to push snow through this in case he had to do this, but he couldn't find the nail and eventually had to abandon the boards. So he had no snowshoes. He went into snow up to his knees, and then he went into snow up to his waist, and apparently then he went up into snow up to his armpits and had to sort of drag himself out several times.
And the thing that I love most about that story is he got to Diamond. He did survive, clearly. He was horribly frostbitten, and so they applied kerosene, which makes perfect sense. Seems to be the medicine of the day. And by the time, a little while later, Laura got a ride on a bobsled and took the train to Cheyenne, he was still in Cheyenne.
He was still in Cheyenne at the hospital. They were treating his frostbitten toes and his feet, make sure he didn't lose any toes. And there she was, and they apparently found out from somebody, "Hey, Earl's actually still in the hospital here." So he was all wanting to get out of town, and here she caught up with him.
I'm talking with John Fry. He is the editor of the new book, Almost Pioneers, One Couple's Homesteading Adventure in the West, written by Laura Gibson Smith many years ago. With me also, Karen Mason, curator of the Iowa Women's Archives at the University of Iowa Libraries. And John, how did you see Laura and Earl changing over this experience? Again, she wrote this book many years after they'd had these adventures, but do you see a change in tone as the stories go on?
Well, one thing I think, and this is partially reveals changes in Laura, partially it may be because of the way she composed the memoir, is that the first several months there, it's very focused on her and Earl and what, you know, they have to do to survive, to get the homestead. The second half of the book is really much more community-oriented. So Laura tells stories about the neighbors who move in and the one-room schoolhouse that's built nearby so that the local children could go to school. And the beginnings of political campaigning in the state. There, she and a neighbor's abortive of attempt to get a ladies' aid club or a women's club going in the neighborhood. So, as the narrative goes along, we see more than just sort of her family-oriented and self-oriented self, but we see her community-oriented self and what's going on in the neighborhood that's being built.
And some failures at community building as well.
Right, right.
Karen, would you read a little bit more for us from Almost Pioneers and set this up for us just a little bit?
Sure. This is a passage that takes place in the fall and winter of 1914. Fall came. The grass had been dry for a long time, cured into nourishing feed for the livestock. All the cattle and horses, fed only on the pastures, were plump and sleek. We decided to have the hay cut in some of the low places where it had grown tall so that we could have feed for Bill, which is their horse, without turning him out at night. That would save time and effort on the cold mornings. Earl had been having hay shipped out from town for emergencies. Herschel Sells came down to do the mowing one Saturday morning and got quite an area cut. He came in for dinner at noon. I knew that such a big man would have a good appetite, so I worked hard to have a good meal and plenty of it. He did justice to it. Then, as he pulled a smelly pipe out of his pocket, he remarked, "I'll go outside to smoke. Always like to smoke after a meal. It gets the taste of the food out of my mouth." Earl grinned at me. He knew I was furious. The two men went outside where Herschel lighted his pipe. They walked around the house, talking about the best places to mow, and sat down in the sun on the south side of the house. Presently, Virginia, the schoolteacher, came downstairs. Very matter-of-factly, she asked, "What is the fire out there north of the house?" "Fire?" I exclaimed and tore upstairs and out of the house to where the men were sitting. "Virginia says there's a fire. Where is it?" They jumped to their feet, ran around the house, and gaped at our own private prairie fire, roaring down across the pasture with the wind driving it faster every second. Earl and Herschel both grabbed gunny sacks, soaked them in the stock tank, and began slapping them futilely at the edges of the fire. In just those few moments, the fire had reached the edge of our land a half mile away. Dr. Day and his wife came running over. All of the Castor family came on the run, as did Dave Gillespie. Shortly afterwards, Elvie drove up with his team on the gallop. Everybody who was within sight of the smoke came as fast as they could, but there was nothing anyone could do. The freakish wind blew the fire across the short, brown, dry grass. The fire raced across the corner of McDonald's pasture and reached a plowed field where it died out. The men piled into Elvie's wagon to make sure it was all burned out. We women went into the house to rest and talk it over. We were very much subdued. The fire could have burnt some of our houses or injured livestock if it hadn't been stopped by that plowed field. Herschel felt terrible about it. He thought he must have tossed his match into the dry grass after he'd lighted his pipe. The strong wind did the rest. Earl tried to make Herschel feel better by pointing out that the fire might have been caused by a spark from the chimney. There was nothing to be done about it, and I think the grass came up thicker the following spring where it had been burned over. I also hoped it had roasted a few rattlesnakes. The men picked out another good spot further east on the claim, and Herschel went back to work mowing the grass. Everybody else went home while I began washing dishes. I could forgive Herschel for starting the fire, but I could never forgive him for telling me that he smoked his pipe to get the taste of my food out of his mouth.
That's Karen Mason, curator of the Iowa Women's Archives at the University of Iowa Library. She's reading from Almost Pioneers, One Couple's Homesteading Adventure in the West, edited by John Fry. And Laura writes about so many of these adventures that they had in great detail, although when their child was born, their oldest son was born, she just kind of skips over that. I was trying to read quickly to prepare for our interview, John, and I missed it. And I went back and I said, wait.
It's right at the end of a chapter. I mean, it's our son arrived on February 15th. We named him Bertle. That's it. I mean, and he doesn't really make much of an appearance. He makes a couple more appearances in the rest of the book. But my wife and I have speculated on some of this. My wife says to me that she thinks that it might have been difficult raising a baby on the homestead and brought back bad memories or something, that this is just not something that she talks very much about.
Yeah. We're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. I'm talking with John Fry and Karen Mason. We're talking today about the book Almost Pioneers, One Couple's Homesteading Adventure in the West. And John Fry will be reading tonight at the Coralville Public Library at 7 p.m. He'll be giving a talk tomorrow morning at 10 a.m. at the Iowa Women's Archives. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. My guests today are John Fry. He is the editor of a new book called Almost Pioneers, One Couple's Homesteading Adventure in the West. It's a memoir written by Laura Gibson Smith, and it's about her adventures with her husband back in 1913, moving out to Wyoming now, 100 years later. It has been published for the first time, and John Fry found this memoir in the Iowa Women's Archives at the University of Iowa Libraries. And Karen Mason is here. She is the curator of the Iowa Women's Archives. John, tell me why Earl and Laura decided to leave this homestead. That was their plan all along, right?
Yeah, I think that it pretty much was. It unfolds a little bit slowly as I read the manuscript and as you read the book, but it becomes clear that they're doing just what they need to get the land, and they don't plan to stay in Wyoming, which was not quite, frankly, not a bad idea. Homesteading in a place like Wyoming is not going to work. It's not a place where you can grow row crops reliably from year to year. There's not enough rainfall. The growing season is very short. I visited there to do research in May one year, and it was down to freezing every night. So you're not going to be able to actually grow something that you can reliably that you can sell. And their plan was to use the land to, they leased it out to a rancher and used the proceeds to fund other pursuits. And in fact, they wanted Earl to be able to finish law school, which is what they did. He was able to finish law school and become a lawyer.
They also went on to move to the Philippines, right?
Yeah, this was another sort of, we think about, you know, Laura and Earl doing impulsive things. They're thinking about how to, you know, what was next. He took the civil service exam for the Philippines, and they moved there. And he was the superintendent or principal of a school in the backwoods of the Philippines. The Philippines was a colony of the United States at the time during the 19-teens, and he was there for two stints, for 3 years during the 19-teens and for 2 years during the 1920s.
As I read this book, as your students read this book, as others pick this up, what do you want us to take away from this?
There's a couple ways of thinking about Lauren Earle's decisions. You can think about it in terms of the regional context about Wyoming. Why does Wyoming still have one of the smallest populations in the country today? Well, it's because it's not a very agreeable place to have dense settlement. It's best for, you know, running cattle and having large ranches. Another context is to think about it as far as the American character. I think that Lauren and Earle are a good example of the type of Americans who are willing to launch out into the unknown, very much into the unknown, in order to better their financial position. And this is something I talk to my students about all through American history, from people who came to indentured servants who came to Jamestown, people who came to New England, people who moved to Iowa in the early 1800s. And but at this point in time, in the early 20th century, free land in the West is no longer really a primary way to get ahead, and education is actually becoming more and more the way to get ahead, and the Smiths are right at the edge of that. They go out to get the land, but that finances his education, and it's his law degree which enables them to realize the American dream back in Iowa.
Karin, you have so many wonderful things in the Iowa Women's Archives, in your collection of letters and diaries and memoirs. How do you know how this manuscript came to be in the collection?
Well, yes. When the archives opened in 1992, there was quite a bit of publicity about it. The Des Moines Register ran a story, and there were speaking engagements and that sort of thing, but radio programs. But I think that Kathy Wheatcraft, who was, you can correct me if I'm wrong, John, I think she was Bert's second wife's daughter-in-law. Is that right?
That's right.
So Laura and Earl's son's second wife's daughter-in-law. Okay.
Right, right. And they came across a box of papers in their basement. And they pulled it out, and they looked at it, and it was Laura's writings from the Philippines. She wrote a lot. She was a writer. She was always taking notes about characters and incidents and planning to write them clearly. So Kathy Wheatcraft called me up and asked whether we would be interested, and I said, sure, that sounds very interesting. And then when she was getting ready to mail it, she said that she had come across this other manuscript. We didn't have a bound version. We didn't get a bound version of the Almost Pioneers. It was probably the original that from which the others were made. And so she put that in, too. So it was almost an afterthought. No, it was not handwritten. It was the typed one that they prepared for the family. Mm-hmm. And so that's how it came to be in the archives. But it was one of the first collections we got. So pretty good.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, and I can imagine that having a typewritten manuscript must have been very exciting, too. You probably go through a lot of difficult-to-read letters and diaries.
That's right. I mean, we love handwritten things because we were taught cursive when we were kids, unlike today's kids. But, yeah, we love getting this sort of thing. But we only have a handful of other homesteaders represented in the archives. But one of them was Mildred Fox, who went out to South Dakota actually in 1905 to teach school. She was from near Oskaloosa, I believe, and someone in her neighborhood had gone out there, and he asked her to come teach school. I think he might have been the superintendent in Pierre, South Dakota. So she went out in 1905 to teach school. She was probably about the same age as Laura and Earl were when they had their grand adventure. And she taught for a couple of years. And what she, I'll read a couple passages.
Sure.
I went out in last of August of 1905. I didn't go out there to take a homestead, but I got the fever after I went out there. The town was full of people coming out to take up land. I went out to teach second primary, which was third and fourth grade, at Fort Pierre, which was right across the Missouri River from Pierre. No railroads into Fort Pierre and no bridge across the river. We went across in a gasoline launch. And so she taught school for a couple of years, and then she took up residence on her land, which was 90 miles away. And she had an aunt who was probably in her 70s or 80s who also took up land. And so these three, and there's another woman too, another elderly woman, and these three single women lived near each other. She said she lived in an 8-by-10-foot shack for 8 months each year, spent her time planting and tending a garden, herding sheep, cooking, washing clothes, and chopping a lot of wood. But after 3 years, like the Smiths, she rented out her land and returned to Iowa, where she taught school in Oskaloosa before marrying and having children. And in this little, this is, again, it's not the most thrilling document to look at. It's a typed transcript of an interview that a family member of Mildred Fox's did with her. Lots of crossings out, X's. But they asked her if she was afraid, and she said, "People said, weren't you afraid? But what was there to be afraid of? There wasn't a tramp out there, and there was no homesteaders in that part. It was all vacant land, so there was nothing to be afraid of, only snakes." And that rattlesnake, that was the thing that everyone was most afraid of. That was true in the 1870s. That was true in the 19-teens and 1905, it seems, right, John?
Yeah. So, well, it was an 8-by-10-foot
Yes.
Shack.
Can you imagine that? A shack is the operative word, I think. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. My.
I mean, the Smiths actually had a fairly large, well, it was 10-by-20-foot, but it was a two-story. The excerpt that you read talks about the school teacher who was living with them for a while, mm-hmm. coming down the steps, and Laura was downstairs. But that's roomy compared to 8-by-10.
Yeah, yeah. And I was surprised, too, that Laura and Earl, they seemed to keep building new houses. You know, they had that shack that they first went to for a few little while, and then they built a house, a sort of a dugout house.
And yeah, it was half underground.
Yeah, and then they built another house so they could be close to their neighbors so she could see their houses, and that made a huge difference for her.
Mm-hmm. Well, and it was also interesting to read about the structures, because clearly just as getting lumber was a problem when the pioneers came to Iowa and the Dakotas, clearly there wasn't a lot of lumber to be had in Wyoming. So it was very interesting to me to read about the cement-poured walls.
Yeah, they would either just pour cement walls, or they would get rocks so that they wouldn't need so much cement, and then put them in behind the forms and then pour the cement around them.
Now, Karen, you have a lot of manuscripts, letters, interviews, things like that in your collection, and a lot of it is handwritten, but now you are working on getting all of this transcribed, and there is an opportunity for the public to get involved. We've talked in the past about the Civil War diaries and some of the cookbooks that the public can get involved in, but let's talk about the letters and diaries and how people can help transcribe them.
Right. We have something called DIY History on the University of Iowa Library's website, and our staff members in the library have been digitizing various collections. We started in the Iowa Women's Archives by digitizing the diaries of Iowa Byington Reed. That was her name, Iowa, who was an Iowa City resident. She lived from 1851 to 1936 and began keeping a diary when she was about 21, and she kept the diary until the day before her death in 1936. So there are 35 volumes of her diary, Wow. And she wrote almost every day. And so all of those diaries have been digitized, and anyone can go in and transcribe a page of the diary. You can transcribe one page, you can transcribe a volume, you can skip around, and it's actually rather addictive once you start doing it, because the first page, you don't really know the handwriting and you don't know who she's talking about. But if you keep going, you start to learn who the people are, who are the characters, and what are the patterns of daily life and what's unusual. And she married a man named Will Reed, who she'd known since she was young. One surprise was that we found out in a bleak way that he had been married before. But she ultimately married him, and they lived on a farm, which is now off First Avenue in Coralville. It's now a gas station. But they talk about going into town, you know, getting the buggy and going into town, so that few miles over to Iowa City. And it's a really fun project. But we have a number of other, so many of those diaries have been transcribed, but there's still a lot to be done. So,
and when these diaries get transcribed, of course, that makes them searchable, because now you have the transcription that can be, used in all kinds of ways. But does that reveal information to you? I suspect that all of these have been gone through before, but do you learn new things because of the transcription?
Well, I should say we will learn new things because of the transcription. What we've learned so far is because of the woman, Christine Tade, who was doing a lot of reviewing the transcriptions that other people had done. And so she was the one who figured out that Will had been married before and that there was found some very interesting things in the diaries. We haven't actually done any analysis yet of the whole diaries, and we'll leave that to the scholars.
Sure, wait till it's all done.
That's right. But I'm sure it will. I think there will be very interesting ways that people can use the diaries when they're searchable.
Do you have a lot of people who are participating in this?
I can't say. I think that there are probably a lot of people who try it out, and then there's a core of people who get hooked and keep coming back and doing more and more.
Well, it sounds like it could be as much fun, maybe more fun than crossword puzzles.
That's right. And we have actually other collections, too, that have been added now. A woman named Ellen Maurer Miller, who was lived in central Boone County, Iowa, in the mid-19th century. And that's an interesting group. We have a little bit of a diary of hers, but we also have a lot of letters of her and her family members. And this was done in part for the Civil War Transcription Project, but also for the Suffrage Project. We had a project to create a digital suffrage collection for the 90th anniversary of the 19th Amendment in 2010. So we've gone back and actually digitized. Instead of just the fragments of collections, we're trying to digitize quite a bit of each collection. So if there's a club that talked about suffrage, instead of just having the one page about suffrage, we have the whole volume of minutes. So people can get a sense of where is this idea about suffrage and anti-suffrage coming from.
We're almost out of time. Can you give us just a short glimpse into the life of another woman whose papers you have?
Sure. I think I would like to go back to Rosa Knutsen Gangested, who was a Norwegian immigrant. She was born in Norway in 1867, and her parents got America fever and emigrated in 1861. They first settled near McGregor and ultimately ended up in Humboldt County in 1872. And she's the one who I mentioned, who also had the fear of rattlesnakes and had a sort of similar experience. But they were just living in a sod hut in Humboldt County, and there were two tribes, Indian tribes nearby. And she, in the 1930s, she wrote a series of stories for her grandchildren describing what it was like to be pioneers. So these were not almost pioneers. These were the real pioneers. So we have some wonderful stories about that.
That's wonderful. So many treasures in there. Yeah, yeah. Well, Karin, thank you so much for being here today.
My pleasure.
Karin Mason is curator of the Iowa Women's Archives at the University of Iowa Libraries. And that is, of course, where John Fry found this manuscript that he has turned into the book Almost Pioneers, One Couple's Homesteading Adventure in the West, written by Laura Gibson Smith, edited by John Fry. We will put up a link to the DIY History, Iowa's Women's Lives, Letters, and Diaries page. So if you want to try your hand at transcribing diaries, you can find that. And if you'd like to find out more about Almost Pioneers, John Fry will be doing a reading this evening at the Coralville Public Library at 7 p.m. Tomorrow morning at 10 o'clock, he'll be speaking at the Iowa Women's Archives. And also he'll be at Beaverdale Books in Des Moines at 1 o'clock on Saturday. John Fry, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you both so much.
Oh, you're welcome.
Talk of Iowa is produced by Dennis Reese, Emily Woodbury, Sarah Bowden, and Ben Stanton. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. Podcasting and on-demand audio of Talk of Iowa are available at iowapublicradio.org. You can send us email anytime, talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Our theme music was composed and performed by the River Monks. I'm Charity Nebbe. Talk of Iowa is a production of Iowa Public Radio News.